Chapter 20. Agonizing that to endure them, I ought to get rid of all outside anxieties, folks say. Now do you want her, sir? Apostrophe, with all my soul. But she doesn't want me. Apostrophe, I don't think she is so against you as you imagine. I fancy if it were put to her plainly, now I am in this state, it might be done. Apostrophe, apostrophe, they lapsed into conversation on the early days of their acquaintance, until Mrs. Pearson's daughter re-entered the room. A vice, apostrophe, said her mother, when the girl had been with them a few minutes. About this matter, that I have talked over with you, so many times since my attack. Here is Mr. Pearson, and he wishes to be your husband. He is much older than you. But, in spite of it, that you will ever get a better husband I don't believe. Now, will you take him, seeing the state I am in, and how naturally anxious I am to see you settled before I die? Apostrophe, apostrophe, but you won't die, mother. You are getting better. Apostrophe, just for the present only. Come, he is a good man and a clever man, and a rich man. I want you, oh so much, to be his wife. I can say no more. Apostrophe, apostrophe, a vice looked appealingly at the sculptor, and then on the floor. Does he really wish me to? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she asked almost inaudibly, turning as she spoke to Pearson. He has never quite said so to me. Apostrophe, my dear one, how can you doubt it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Jocelyn quickly. But I won't press you to marry me as a favor, against your feelings. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I thought Mr. Pearson was younger. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she murmured to her mother. That counts for little, when you think how much there is on the other side. Think of our position, and of his a sculptor, with a mansion, and a studio full of busts and statues, that I have dusted in my time, and of the beautiful studies you would be able to take up. Surely the life would just suit you? Your expensive education is wasted down here. Apostrophe, apostrophe, a vice did not care to argue. She was outwardly gentle as her grandmother had been, and it seemed just a question with her, of whether she must or must not. Very well, I feel I ought to agree to marry him, since you tell me to, apostrophe, she answered quietly, after some thought. I see that it would be a wise thing to do, and that you wish it, and that Mr. Pearson really does like me. So that apostrophe, Pearson was not backward at this critical juncture, despite unpleasant sensations. But it was the historic ingredient in this genealogical passion, if its continuity through three generations, may be so described, which appealed to his perseverance at the expense of his wisdom. The mother was holding the daughter's hand. She took Pearson's, and laid the vices in it. No more was said in argument, and the thing was regarded as determined. Afterwards a noise was heard upon the window panes, as of fine sand thrown, and, lifting the blind, Pearson saw that the distant lightship winked with a bleared and indistinct eye. A drizzling rain had come on with the dark, and it was striking the window in handfuls. He had intended to walk the 2 miles back to the station, but it meant a drenching to do it now. He waited and had supper, and, finding the weather no better, accepted Mrs. Pearson's invitation to stay over the night. Thus it fell out that again he lodged in the house he had been accustomed to live in as a boy, before his father had made his fortune, and before his own name had been heard of outside the boundaries of the isle. He slept but little, and in the first movement of the dawn sat up in bed. Why should he ever live in London or any other fashionable city, if this plan of marriage could be carried out? Surely, with this young wife, the island would be the best place for him. It might be possible to rent Sylvania Castle as he had formerly done, better still to buy it. If life could offer him anything worth having, it would be a home with a vice there on his native cliffs to the end of his days. As he sat thus thinking, and the daylight increased, he discerned, a short distance before him, a movement of something ghostly. His position was facing the window, and he found that by chance the looking glass had swung itself vertical, so that what he saw was his own shape. The recognition startled him. The person he appeared was too grievously far, chronologically, in advance of the person he felt himself to be. Pearson did not care to regard the figure confronting him so mockingly. Its voice seemed to say there's tragedy hanging on to this. But the question of age being pertinent, he could not give the specter up, and ultimately got out of bed under the weird fascination of the reflection. Whether he had overwalked himself lately, or what he had done, he knew not, but never had he seemed so aged by a score of years as he was represented in the glass in that cold gray morning light. While his soul was what it was, why should he have been encumbered with that withering carcass, without the ability to shift it off for another, as his ideal beloved had so frequently done? By reason of her mother's illness, a vice was now living in the house, and, on going downstairs, he found that they were to breakfast and tete-a-tete. She was not then in the room, but she entered in the course of a few minutes. Pearson had already heard that the widow felt better this morning, and elated by the prospect of sitting with a vice at this meal, he went forward to her joyously. As soon as she saw him in the full stroke of day from the window, she started, and he then remembered that it was their first meeting under the solar rays. She was so overcome that she turned and left the room, as if he had forgotten something. When she re-entered, she was visibly pale. She recovered herself, and apologized. As he had been sitting up the night before the last, she said, and was not quite so well as usual. There may have been some truth in this, but Pearson could not get over that first scared look of hers. It was enough to give daytime stability to his night views of a possible tragedy lurking in this wedding project. He determined that, at any cost to his heart, there should be no misapprehension about him from this moment. Miss Pearson, he said as they sat down, since it is well you should know all the truth, before we go any further, that there may be no awkward discoveries afterwards, I am going to tell you something about myself, if you are not too distressed to hear it. No, let me hear it. I was once the lover of your mother, and wanted to marry her, only she wouldn't, or rather couldn't, marry me. Oh, how strange. Said the girl, looking from him to the breakfast things, and from the breakfast things to him. Mother has never told me that. Yet of course, you might have been. I mean, you are old enough. He took the remark as a satire as he had not intended. Oh yes, quite old enough, he said grimly. Almost too old. Too old for mother? How's that? Because I belong to your grandmother. No? How can that be? I was her lover likewise. I should have married her, if I had gone straight on instead of round the corner. But you couldn't have been, Mr. Pearson. You are not old enough? Why, how old are you? You have never told me. I am very old. My mother's, and my grandmother's, said she, looking at him no longer as at a possible husband, but as a strange fossilized relic in human form. Pearson saw it, but meaning to give up the game, he did not care to spare himself. Your mother's and your grandmother's, young man, he repeated. And were you my great-grandmother's too? She asked, with an expectant interest in his case as a drama that overcame her personal considerations for a moment. No, not your great-grandmother's. Your imagination beats even my confessions. But I am very old, as you see. I did not know it. Said she in an appalled murmur. You do not look so, and I thought that, what you looked you were. And you are very young, he continued. A stillness followed, during which she sat in a troubled constraint, regarding him now, and then with something in her open eyes and large pupils, that might have been sympathy or nervousness. Pearson ate scarce any breakfast, and rising abruptly from the table said he would take a walk on the cliffs as the morning was fine. He did so, proceeding along the northeast heights for nearly a mile. He had virtually given the vice up, but not formally. His intention had been to go back to the house in half an hour, and pay a morning visit to the invalid. But by not returning, the plans of the previous evening might be allowed to lapse silently, as mere purplers, that had come to nothing in the face of a vice's want of love for him. Pearson accordingly went straight along, and in the course of an hour, was at his Budmouth lodgings. Nothing occurred till the evening, to inform him how his absence had been taken. Then a note arrived from Mrs. Pearson. It was written in pencil, evidently as she lay. "I am alarmed," apostrophe she said, "at your going so suddenly. A vice seems to think as he has offended you. She did not mean to do that, I am sure. It makes me dreadfully anxious. Will you send a line? Surely you will not desert us now my heart is so set on my child's welfare." "Desert you I won't," said Jocelyn. "It is too much like the original case. But I must let her desert me." On his return, with no other object than that of wishing Mrs. Pearson goodbye, he found her painfully agitated. She clasped his hand, and wetted it with her tears. "Oh, don't be offended with her!" She cried. "She's young. We are one people, don't marry a Kimberlyn. It will break my heart, if you forsake her now." "A vice?" The girl came. "My manner was hasty and thoughtless this morning," she said in a low voice. "Please pardon me. I wish to abide by my promise." Her mother, still tearful, again joined their hands, and the engagement stood as before. Pearson went back to Budmouth, but dimly seeing how curiously, through his being a rich suitor, ideas of beneficence and reparation were attaining him in the course arranged by her mother, and urged by his own desire in the face of his understanding. 3. 5. On the verge of possession, in anticipation of his marriage, Pearson had taken a new red house of the approved Kensington pattern, with a new studio at the back as large as a medieval barn. Hither, in collusion with the elder of vice whose health had mended somewhat, he invited mother and daughter, to spend a week or two with him, thinking thereby to exercise on the latter's imagination an influence which was not practicable while he was a guest at their house, and by interesting his betrothed in the fitting and furnishing of this residence, to create in her an ambition to be its mistress. It was a pleasant, reposeful time to be in town. There was nobody to interrupt them in their proceedings, and, it being out of the season, the largest tradesmen were as attentive to their wants, as if those firms had never before been honored with a single customer whom they really liked. Pearson and his guests, almost equally inexperienced, for the sculptor had nearly forgotten what knowledge of householding he had acquired earlier in life could consider, and practiced thoroughly a species of skeleton drill in receiving visitors, when the pair should announce themselves as married, and at home in the coming winter season. A vice was charming, even if a little cold. He congratulated himself yet again that time should have reserved for him this final chance for one of the line. She was somewhat like her mother, whom he had loved in the flesh, but as he had the soul of her grandmother, whom he had loved in the spirit, and, for that matter, loved now. Only one criticism had he to pass upon his choice. Though in outward semblance her grand dame idealized, as he had not the first of vice's candor, but rather her mother's closeness. He never knew exactly what she was thinking and feeling, yet he seemed to have such prescriptive rights in women of her blood, that her occasional want of confidence did not deeply trouble him. It was one of those ripe and mellow afternoons that sometimes color London with their golden light at this time of the year, and produce those marvelous sunset effects which, if they were not known to be made up of kitchen coal smoke and animal exhalations, would be rapturously applauded. Behind the perpendicular, oblique, zigzagged, and curved zinc tall boys, apostrophe that formed a gray pattern not unlike early Gothic numerals against the sky. The men and women on the tops of the omnibuses saw an irradiation of topaz hues, darkened here and there in the richest russet. There had been a sharp shower during the afternoon, and Pearson, who had to take care of himself, had worn a pair of galoshes on his short walk in the street. He noiselessly entered the studio, inside which some gleams of the same mellow light had managed to creep, and where he guessed he should find his prospective wife and mother-in-law waiting him with tea. But only a vice was there, seated beside the teapot of brown delf, which, as artists, they affected, her back being toward him. She was holding her handkerchief to her eyes, and he saw that she was weeping silently. In another moment he perceived that she was weeping over a book. By this time S.E. had heard him, and came forward. He made it appear that he had not noticed her distress, and they discussed some arrangements of furniture. When he had taken a cup of tea she went away, leaving the book behind her. Pearson took it up. The volume was an old school book, Stevenard's Lectures Francaises, apostrophe with her name in it as a pupil at Sandburn High School, and date markings denoting lessons taken at a comparatively recent time, for Vice had been but a novice as governess when he discovered her. For a schoolgirl which she virtually was to weep over a schoolbook was strange. Could she have been affected by some subject in the readings? Impossible. Pearson fell to thinking, and zest died for the process of furnishing, which he had undertaken so gaily. Somehow, the bloom was again disappearing from his approaching marriage. Yet he loved Vice more and more tenderly. He feared sometimes that in the solicitousness of his affection he was spoiling her, by indulging her every whim. He looked round the large and ambitious apartment, now becoming clouded with shades, out of which the white and cadaverous countenances of his studies, casts, and other lumber peered meditatively at him, as if they were saying, "What are you going to do now, old boy?" They had never looked like that, while standing in his past homely workshop, where all the real labors of his life had been carried out. What should a man of his age, who had not for years done anything to speak of, certainly not to add to his reputation as an artist, want with a new place like this? It was all because of the elect lady, and she apparently did not want him. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.